from the historic campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, where the good, the true, and the beautiful are taught, nurtured, and honored. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, bringing the activity and education of the college to listeners across the country.
We know why the American Revolution was fought. We have a document called the Declaration of Independence in which Thomas Jefferson laid out many grievances against the crown. The threat of abolition wasn't one of them.
This is your host, Scott Bertram, and that's Peter Wood, author of 1620, A Critical Response to the 1619 Project. We'll talk with him a bit later on today's program. Our first guest is Dr. Khalil Habib, Associate Professor of Politics at Hillsdale College. We talk about nationalism versus cosmopolitanism. And we start with a definition of sorts. What would you say makes a country nationalistic?
It's a difficult concept to really define because different nations define their nationalism differently. But if you want to contrast it to cosmopolitanism, I think we can get closer to the mark. Cosmopolitanism essentially means a universal city, cosmopolis. And a cosmopolitan would be somebody who referred to him or herself as a universal citizen, as opposed to somebody who is defined by the particularity of their tradition, or their race or their location. And so quite often nationalism refers to a people who coalesce around a shared past, in some cases a shared race, language, religion, location. Nationalism tends to be rooted in history. As opposed to cosmopolitanism, which is philosophic in origin, actually, whereas nationalism and nationalists who have supported such positions tend to look to history and a people's unique past and its unique identity as the defining feature of their politics.
What are different possible foundations of unity in a nationalistic society?
Again, I think it would depend on the nationalistic regime that you're referring to. For some, it boils down to what some would refer to as blood and soil, a people's race or their location and history. But depending on how you define nationalism, it could also refer to certain political principles. For example, John Jay in his first Federalist paper, which is Federalist 2, isn't exactly making a case for nationalism, but he is making a case for what he saw as an American source of unity. He points out, for example, that there's a shared language, there's a shared history in fighting tyranny, that even the geography of America seems to suggest and encourage a kind of unity in geography. But that kind of unity, though, is grounded in the consensus of the founders' view that natural rights and property rights, among others, is really the basis of the uniqueness of American nationalism.
Dr. Khalil Habib with us, Associate Professor of Politics at Hillsdale College here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. How does nationalism relate to the social contract theory of government?
In many ways, it's opposed to it, again, depending on which philosopher of the natural social contract theory, rather, that you're referring to. For example, Rousseau, in the Second Discourse, argues for a certain kind of republican nationalism that's rooted in religion, but also in the sentiments. It's, again, a certain shared sentiment that people feel together that unites them, a certain kind of affection. You know, even Aristotle, who didn't have a taste for nationalism, he preferred something far smaller, what he referred to as the polis, talks about how family and private property and moral virtue, the participation in government, all help to build affection for one's own. And although that's not nationalism, there is a certain kind of civic health in that for Aristotle. By social contract theory, we tend to refer to someone like John Locke.
Right.
And in John Locke's case, natural rights is essentially the idea that all human beings, by virtue of being human, are free and equal to others, and that no one person has any coercive authority, legitimate coercive authority, over another. And in that case, one's locale, one's religion, one's race, for example, would be irrelevant because he's grounding the basis of a social contract on something that is essential to all men, all rational all rational human beings. But Rousseau, again, rejected that, and in his work, The Social Contract, argued for a certain kind of nationalism that was built upon the general will. And he literally wrote that as a way to repudiate Hobbes and Locke and the social contract theory, largely because he thought that only the general will, a small nationalistic country, mostly homogenous, could actually secure the liberties that were promised in a social contract theory.
Let's switch gears. Let's talk more about cosmopolitanism. You mentioned earlier that there was perhaps more of a philosophical foundation to cosmopolitanism. Where did those ideas originate?
According to the tradition, and as far as we know, the first cosmopolitan philosopher was a fellow by the name of Diogenes of Sinope, circa 412. He's generally associated with the school of Cynic philosophy, and a story that is often told about him is that he was once asked, to what city or nation does he belong to? And he famously said, I'm a citizen of the world, implying, of course, that he's not defined by birth or any accidental features that he felt were arbitrary. And what made him who he is qua man, something far more universal. But there are ideas of cosmopolitanism that go beyond simply the Greek world. There is a medieval story written by Ibn Tufayl called Hayya ibn Yaqsan, in which you have this young boy miraculously born in a deserted island, and through unassisted human reason and without any contact with any human being, comes to knowledge of God and self-knowledge and a certain awareness that he somehow belongs to a common species, even though he hadn't even come into contact with anybody. But ultimately, though, for Ibn Tufayl, he rejects the idea that you could inform particular nations with these cosmopolitan ideas. He's rescued temporarily from his island and brought to what's clearly an Islamic nation. And when he seeks to enlighten them about his God and his revelations that he had discovered on his own, he quickly realizes that it's not practicable, and in fact his ideas pose a threat to this one nation that hosts him, and so he takes off and returns to his city. So variations of cosmopolitanism have been around both in the West and in the Islamic world, and some have been favorably viewed and some have been criticized.
And we do have these more globally minded institutions, the United Nations, the WTO, others. Do you think they are contributing to the rise of cosmopolitanism?
I do, but I think that they are. It would be putting the cart before the horse. I think commerce played the initial role of making those organizations first viable. One of the things that Montesquieu and Smith and others argue, who are in favor of free trade and commercial activity, international trade, I think that lays the foundation for the basis of having something like the European Union or an international criminal court. And those organizations, in theory and in principle, are designed to protect commercial relations informed by some kind of cosmopolitan idea of humanity as individuals belonging to a global community, as opposed to a particular locale and a people.
We've spent some time here with Dr. Khalil Habib talking about nationalism and cosmopolitanism. Do you think, in a way, this is a particularly timely discussion when we analyze what's happening around the world today?
I do, and I can't help but think, for example, of Brexit when you ask that question. The immigration issue in Europe has really brought the question of cosmopolitanism versus national sovereignty back into the public, and what you're seeing there is the consequences of uniting in the form of a cosmopolitan world order versus independent nations or nations wishing to assert and reassert their national sovereignty, such as the case of England, for example. So I do think it's important, and I do think it's topical.
Dr. Khalil Habib, Associate Professor of Politics at Hillsdale College, thank you so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
My pleasure. It's good to be with you, Scott.
Up next, Peter Wood joins us, author of 1620, A Critical Response to the 1619 Project. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. To find out more about Hillsdale College, head to hillsdale.edu. We're joined now by Peter Wood, president of the National Association of Scholars and author of the new book, 1620, A Critical Response to the 1619 Project. Peter, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
For those who perhaps only have heard the phrase 1619 Project, what's a brief overview? What's the 1619 Project all about?
Well, the 1619 Project was a special issue of the New York Times Magazine that was issued on August 18th, 2019, 400 years from the date in which they claim America was actually founded. On that date, a ship brought a cargo of 20-some, no one knows quite the number, African slaves to Jamestown, Virginia. And from that point onward, according to this 1619 Project, America was a place of white supremacy in which the position and wealth, the influence, the social control of whites was gained entirely by the immiseration of blacks, that chattel slavery began at that point and continued until the passage of the 13th Amendment. But even then, the white supremacy begun in Jamestown in 1619 was the hallmark of American life politically, economically, socially, religiously, in every domain of human activity. This is the story of America. So that's what the 1619 Project is all about.
So if the 1619 Project attempts to say that that is the year that defines America and where America really begins, the book, 1620, A Critical Response to the 1619 Project, takes us 1 year into the future in 1620. Why do you argue that that is the proper starting point for the American story?
Well, I'm looking at the signing of the Mayflower Compact on November 11, 1620, as the event that I'm nominating as an alternative to 1619. Of course, if you are seriously interested in the history of America, no date looms larger than 1776 and the Declaration of Independence. But if we're willing to go back and excavate to the important events that led up to the American Revolution, I would say the earliest and most important of those was this Mayflower Compact. Why do I say that? Because the arrival of the Mayflower off the coast of Cape Cod was a crisis for those on board, some of whom were religious dissenters, the people we call pilgrims, and some of whom were just English settlers intending on finding their new homes in northern Virginia. The pilgrims called them strangers. So we have pilgrims and strangers. The strangers declared as they came to the coast of Cape Cod that now they were outside British jurisdiction. The contracts they had signed back in England to be indentured servants or to work within the structure of the Virginia Company were null and void, and they could go where they want and do what they want from this point forward. They had very few provisions left on board, and they had no idea what kind of reception they would have from the native inhabitants. So a quarrel broke out. Pilgrims thought that they needed to stick together. The strangers thought, no way. Out of this came a very terse agreement, it's just short of 200 words, in which they agreed to form a civil body politic. They were going to elect their own leaders, establish their own laws, treat one another as equals with no distinction of religion or class, and in effect they created a model of self-government for a small community in the New World.
Peter Wood is with us. His book, 1620, A Critical Response to the 1619 Project. You write that the 1619 Project consists of an effort to destroy America by teaching children that America never really existed. It eradicates American history and American values in one sweep. What do you mean by that?
Well, the New York Times' declaration, mostly through the words of Nicole Hannah Jones, the lead author and editor of the magazine is quite explicit about this. America's principles were false when they were written, she says. The notions of freedom and equality, which we generally take as the hallmarks of the American experiment, were just lies meant to cover over the oppression that was really the heart of the enterprise. The telling of American history through this lens diminishes the American founding in 1776 to a kind of nullity. It was a rebellion against the British in order to preserve slavery, says Nicole Hannah-Jones. American prosperity grew not by the cultivation of a continent and all its possibilities, but by the creation of the plantation system, which created low-road American capitalism, as they phrase it. The American healthcare system is derivative of the maltreatment of American slaves. There is nothing, according to Nicole Hannah-Jones and company, that has ever advanced the position of black people in America other than self-help. So in one sweep, the abolition movement, largely led by whites, the civil rights movement, in which many whites were collaborative with black leaders, all just disappear into this story of endless oppression and immiseration.
Peter, there have been objections raised by historians to the narrative and the facts, quote-unquote, put forward by the 1619 Project. There have been some corrections and changes made to those original stories. What do they get so wrong?
Well, I think they get so wrong begins with the arrival of those slaves in Virginia in 1619. A pirate ship, an English pirate ship, had intercepted a Spanish slave ship in the Caribbean, taken on board the slaves, sold most of them in Bermuda, and took the remainder north, where they were running short of provisions and the ship was damaged in a storm. They traded their slaves for food at Jamestown, but Jamestown did not have a system of slavery or even a recognized status of slave. It promptly turned these poor captives into indentured servants, and after a few years set them free. They intermarried with the white population. They became landowners. Some of them had success in court in suing other people, white people. So it was clear that what happened in 1619 was a strange form of racial integration rather than the beginning of slavery. Slavery lay some 50 years into the future at that point. So this thing begins with a kind of gross misrepresentation of one episode of American history and then proceeds through a falsification of all of American history. As I mentioned, the treatment of the American Revolution as an effort to preserve slavery against the threat of British abolition is just a complete fairy tale. We know why the American Revolution was fought. We have a document called the Declaration of Independence in which Thomas Jefferson laid out many grievances against the crown. The threat of abolition wasn't one of them.
Peter Wood, president of the National Association of Scholars and also author of 1620, A Critical Response to the 1619 Project. Peter, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
I'm very happy to have been here. Thank you.
Up next, we talk with Matt Gaetano from Hillsdale's History Department as he tells us about Pico and his oration on the dignity of man. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Founded in 1995, GI Pathology is the only physician-owned laboratory in the United States dedicated solely to the practice of gastrointestinal and liver pathology. The company provides the highest quality GI pathology diagnosis made exclusively by one of our fellowship-trained gastrointestinal and liver pathologists. GI Pathology delivers results to its Northern California client base within an industry-leading 24 hours. Call 888-2-GI-PATH or go to www.gipath.com for more information.
We are Women of Vision. We have exciting news. We will no longer be on for Tuesday nights at 6 p.m.
Our new home will be with North State Now, last Thursday of the month, starting January 2021.
North State Now is a magazine-formatted show where every Thursday night a different host highlights people, places, entertainment, local heroes, arts, and women of vision.
Women of Vision is a movement, women empowering women. Join us for North State Now, last Thursday of the month, 6 to 7 p.m. on KCNR 96.5 FM.
This is Judy Maxwell. Life can happen in an instant. Sometimes you plan for it, like retirement or taking care of your family. Sometimes it's a surprise, like a winter storm with home or property damage. Sometimes it may be an unexpected accident or illness or even a premature death. Whatever life throws at you, you'll wish you had gotten the right insurance when you had the chance. That's where Maxwell Insurance can help. For more than a quarter century, we've been serving the North State because it's our home, too. Give us a call at 221-0441 to let us help you review your policies and prepare you for whatever your future holds. Maxwell Insurance, 1378 Hilltop Drive, 221-0441.
Every Monday from 6 to 8 p.m., join us at Radio Wasteland, your local guide to the unexplained and the unknown. Each week, we cover all things unexplained, from the moving stars in the sky to the things that go bump in the night. Visit us as we explore these topics and more as our in-studio team digs deeper with featured guests and listener call-ins. Mondays are rough, but now your overworked brain has the chance for some sweet relief with Radio Wasteland.
Radio Wasteland, Mondays at 6 on KCNR.
Slow down.
Hi, this is Dr. Trudy Pratt. My chiropractic and nutrition practice in downtown Reading has been helping people feel better for over 20 years. We pride ourselves in really listening to our patients and then tailoring a program of nutrition, chiropractic care, massage, and exercise that's just right for you. The results can be dramatic. Call 244-7873. That's 244-7873. Thank you.
From the Pacific Justice Institute, this is The Legal Edge.
The total questions on the citizenship test have increased from 100 to 128. Questions about freedom of the press and religion have decreased. Questions about religious freedom have declined from 7 to 3. And freedom of the press questions are gone altogether. Visit PJI.org.
Learn more about our ministry and get exclusive email updates by registering for The Legal Insider at PJI.org.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. You can get an email every time there's a new episode of the show available. Go to radiohour.hillsdale.edu and enter your address, radiohour.hillsdale.edu. We're joined by Dr. Matthew Gaetano, Associate Professor of History at Hillsdale College. Dr. Gaetano, thanks for joining us.
Great to be with you, Scott.
And talking today about Pico's oration. So as we begin, tell us what we know about Pico, what this oration is, and the time frame we're sort of looking at, too.
Yeah, so Pico della Mirandola, his first name was Giovanni, John, was born in the 1460s, 1463, I believe, and died in 1494. So relatively young man to have made such an impact, 31 years old or so when he died. Living in the time of kind of, you know, the power of the Medici in Renaissance Florence, and he was this kind of wunderkind, this person who was in a way famous for being famous even during his own life. You know, apparently incredibly good looking, learned multiple languages, and that was very common to learn Latin and Greek, but he's learning Hebrew, working on his Arabic. He studies, of course, in Florence, this haven of Renaissance humanism. He's studying with the great Marsilio Ficino, the translator of Plato. But he also went to the University of Paris, which was the great university of the Middle Ages, and was learning the more conventional scholastic academic theology and philosophy. He studied at the University of Padua, which was another great university in northern Italy. So in some ways, he draws together in himself so many of these threads of this kind of high Renaissance Italian period of Italian cultural fluorescence in the late 1400s.
So the oration has been called the Manifesto of the Renaissance. Would you agree with that in some way? How do you think it showcases what the Renaissance is about?
Yeah, the interesting thing is that I think in a lot of ways Pico did capture the imagination of quite a number of people in his own day, in this period that we know as the Renaissance. But in a lot of respects, Diocletian, and Pico himself, was a rather unusual humanist. And I know we'll talk about humanism in another context, but Pico wasn't as devoted to just like learning some Latin, learning some Greek, making Italy great again, you know, this education and virtue. He was really ambitious in his kind of theological speculations, in his metaphysical speculations. Again, the learning of Hebrew. He wanted to go beyond the Romans, beyond mm-hmm. the Greeks, to something more ancient, and in some ways actually more tied to, you know, the Christian faith, the Christian religion. I still would see it as an oration about human dignity. And this is something that we tend to associate with the Renaissance. We think of the art and the architecture and the statues
right.
that capture the human form. But Pico wasn't talking about the greatness of the human body or the human form. There was something actually very mystical in the oration of the dignity of man. It was about actually in some ways moving beyond the human, rivaling and competing with the angels in a desire to be united with God. Again, that's a pretty profound vision of human dignity, but I think in a lot of ways departs from certainly our standard images of the Renaissance vision of the human being,
mm-hmm.
and I think in a lot of ways it was a rather unusual view.
Talking with Dr. Matthew Gaetano, Associate Professor of History here at Hillsdale College, about Pico's oration. What is the great chain of being that he talks about?
Right. So Pico is actually drawing this from a much older tradition and something that really did carry through the Middle Ages, which is simply that in some ways, well, God is the supreme being or beyond being because of his transcendence. And then you have different levels of how you imitate or how similar, how much you resemble God, how much the traces of God are in different creatures. So you go from angels to man to beasts, plants, rocks. And the standard view, even of his teacher, Marsilio Ficino, the great Platonist, is kind of man is in the middle, right? The human being is in between the angelic and the material order because we have both a rational intellectual soul and a body. And what's interesting is Pico starts there, but actually says, that's actually not a very satisfying account of human dignity, mm-hmm. of human greatness in some ways, because, again, this silly idea that Renaissance people wanted to overthrow God and put man in the center of the universe, I just think is a deeply flawed and problematic idea. But what Pico is saying is that humans, in a way, rival the angels. And if it's just we're greater than the animals because we're smart or because we have intellects, well, angels are intellects.
Mm-hmm.
And what Pico seems to want to do is to say that in some ways human beings more resemble God because God creates all things, including the material order, and we have not only the angelic power of intelligence that God makes, but we also have the seeds of all the material order of things that God has also made. We grow like plants. We move like animals.
In the oration, Pico is trying to defend philosophy. Is he defending philosophy classically understood or defending something different?
Yeah, so I mean, I think in a lot of ways he is defending philosophy with a deeply classical understanding. Aristotle and Plato were his ancient philosophical heroes. So that's kind of pretty standard stuff. But I think Pico is looking at, and this is where he's a bit unusual as a humanist, he's looking at some of the humanists and saying, you're so focused on educating people into being eloquent, being able to use these linguistic tools, and perhaps being good, virtuous citizens, that perhaps you've lost sight of our search for transcendence, our search for the infinite that we find in God. And I think the way in which he's trying to, if you will, sell philosophy or promote kind of this philosophical pursuit is rooted less in, cultivate your nature, right? His whole point is that our nature is a bit fluid. We have the mm-hmm. seeds of all of these different parts of creation. And so what I think he's saying is whatever seeds you cultivate, that's what you're going to become, right? If you act like a plant, you're going to become plant-like. If you act like a beast, you're going to become beast-like. If you act like an angel or like God, you're going to become divine and angelic. And so where you end up on this great chain of being, in a sense, has less to do with how smart you were born to be, but how much you love and what you love.
Final question here for Dr. Matthew Gaetano on Pico's oration. Who then is influenced by the oration? Where do we see its influence in the future?
The oration really comes into its own in the early 1800s, and it was really attached to, you know, defenses of human dignity in Germany, kind of around Immanuel Kant and so on and so forth. And then when great books courses and Western civilization courses were put together in the 20s and eventually the 40s and the 50s, this little snippet from the oration becomes, you know, this manifesto of the mm-hmm. Renaissance. But they end up not putting a lot of the stuff about the angels and so on and so forth. It's more about be free, choose where you want to end up. And I think that's where a lot of the debates about Pico, which, you know, have really, you know, radiated through scholarship, but even some popular discussions of the Renaissance, where some people say, oh, look, this vision of freedom, make yourself who you are. And understandably, some conservatives mm-hmm. look at that and say, we have a nature, act in accordance with your nature. And I think, I hope, when we read the entire oration, and we see the oration in the context of Pico's life, where what he's trying to do is defend peace, defend philosophy, really inspire his fellow man to this, yeah, philosophical and theological ambition. I think in the context of the work as a whole, we start to see, you know, what Pico was really trying to do in the context of his own time.
Dr. Matthew Gaetano, Associate Professor of History at Hillsdale College, talking Pico's oration. Dr. Gaetano, thanks for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
My pleasure.
Up next, we'll talk with Matthew Honig, a 2016 graduate of Hillsdale College, who's been involved with some fossil digs over the past few years. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Hi, this is Mark from Haven Humane Society. It has been a challenging couple of years, and through it all, our amazing team has continued to save lives. We have so many fantastic animals that are looking for their forever homes, and with adoption fees so low, now is the time to add to your family. With puppies, kittens, dogs, cats, and so many more, we have the perfect addition. Come join our team as a volunteer and help in an area that works for you. Walking dogs, socializing cats, helping in our veterinary hospital, or folding laundry. We have many opportunities and welcome all volunteers. For more information, please visit our website at havenhumane.org or follow us on Facebook. On behalf of the entire Haven team, thank you for all of your continued support as together we get closer every day to North State with no more homeless pets.
This is Ted Lighty with Northern Firearms Instruction. Do you have a crazy schedule and can't seem to get to a class to qualify for your CCW, CCW renewal, or maybe learn to use that new firearm you just purchased? Consider a private class with NFI. Learn to shoot a handgun, rifle, shotgun, or even a BB gun. Classes are taught by an instructor that you choose on your dates and location. Give NFI a call at 530-999-1822 or visit us online at usgunpro.com. This is Ted Lighty, and I'll see you at the range.
This Hawaiian mini vacation is brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. So what does professional office cleaning have to do with relaxing in a tropical paradise? Frankly, nothing. But Maui Bob and the crew want to remind you to be sure to take the time for what's important in this workaday world. Family, friends, and yes, even yourself. And if their professional office cleaning services can help you make that time, give them a call at 221-5868. This Hawaiian mini vacation was brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning, 221-5868.
If you think mainstream media is telling you the truth about critically important issues, think again. Do you want factually verifiable answers to your questions? The Real News Q&A Hour on KCNR Radio, Saturday mornings from 8 to 9 a.m. will provide factually verifiable answers to your questions. Tune in or call to join in the conversation. Let's fill in the blanks to the questions mainstream media refuses to even ask. This is Dane Wigington with GeoengineeringWatch.org.
As Shasta County gradually reopens for business, we can all do our part to stop the spread of COVID-19 by wearing a mask when in public. Cloth face coverings help reduce the spread of germs by preventing the release of droplets when someone speaks, coughs, or sneezes. Wash your face covering often, ideally after each use or at least daily. Wash with detergent and hot water and dry on a hot cycle. Here is Shasta County Health Officer Dr. Karen Ramstrom.
Remember, wearing a face covering is not a replacement for physical distancing, frequent hand washing, and staying home when sick. Your mask protects me, and my mask protects you. Together, we can stop the spread.
For more information, including how to make your own cloth face covering, go to ShastaReady.org.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. We're joined now by Matthew Honig. He's a 2017 graduate of Hillsdale College, where he majored in biology, minors in chemistry and German, currently working as an intern at an environmental company in Ohio, also involved in some pretty interesting digs for fossils over the past couple of years. Matthew, thank you so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
We will get to the fun stuff. It's all fun stuff, but the fossil digs in a little bit. But we did want to talk to you first a little about your time here at Hillsdale College, a 2017 grad. What do you remember going into the process of choosing Hillsdale College?
My parents had mentioned Hillsdale College to me after hearing about it on some talk radio shows. They have two older sisters. I believe one of them visited Hillsdale while doing college visits, so I knew that the college existed. And then I actually visited Hillsdale when I was a junior in high school, so almost 10 years ago now. Visited Hillsdale as one of several colleges that I looked at. Of the colleges that I looked at, Hillsdale stood out to me the most as far as its environment, academics, culture, and whatnot went. So Hillsdale was always the front runner in my mind when it came to applying to colleges.
What memories stick out most from your time here at Hillsdale?
It's very difficult to narrow down. I think the most important memories that I carry are the memories of the friends and friendships that I had there and the people I continue to associate with. Mm-hmm. And I also remember fondly the academics and lessons and whatnot that I learned throughout my time at Hillsdale. So it's a little difficult to choose.
Tell us a little bit about the opportunities and what you experienced as a science, science focus with bio and chemistry and then a biology major for those students here at Hillsdale. What kind of opportunities are there?
Hillsdale has a very good science program. As far as bio goes, we have very good coursework and many good opportunities both in the lab and in the field. As an example, I worked in the genetics lab, and the genetics lab has its own cycle sequencer, which is a piece of scientific equipment that costs $1 to maybe even $3. And most small schools do not have one. When they would like to sequence a sample, they will usually send them out to another lab. So that's one example of the amazing resources that are available to biology and natural science students at Hillsdale, that we have genetic sequencer. Mm-hmm. That's one example of many of the pieces of equipment that are available for students to learn about and use. In addition to that, Hillsdale also has really great research opportunities for all of the sciences. Many students do research there over the summer, and at least in the biology department, all students were required to carry out research and present it to their classmates and the professors as a prerequisite for graduation. There are also great field opportunities. Dr. Swinehart takes students down to the Florida Keys, usually every other summer, and I got to go with him to prospect for fossils in the Elk Creek Formation.
Talking with Matthew Honig with us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, 2017 grad of Hillsdale College. You mentioned the research work a bit, and we've talked with Anthony Swinehart previously, Dr. Swinehart here on the show, about some of the biology things. We've talked with Dr. Timothy Dolch about some of the physics research that happens on campus. What are those things that the students are working on research-wise while they are still enrolled, while they are still students here at Hillsdale?
It depends on the student and the department. I worked on a critically endangered species of plant from Hawaii. Other students have worked on all manner of topics. A friend of mine named Allie worked on caddisfly genetics. Another friend, Sheldon, worked on genotoxicity of Roundup. I remember another presentation in which someone looked at the supposed antioxidant properties of a miracle pill that had lots of antioxidants. Turns out it didn't actually work. I remember other students looked at turtle population dynamics at the Hillsdale College Biological Station. It really depends. If you're interested in studying something, there's a good chance that you could find a professor at Hillsdale who's willing to work with you on that.
So there are a lot of options and available pathways here for certain. Eventually we'd get to the quote-unquote fun stuff in a bit. I know you've been involved with some fossil digs with Dr. Swinehart, and there was a recent discovery that you assisted on, a shark discovery right here in the state of Michigan. We talked a bit about this with Dr. Swinehart previously, but tell people, remind people what this was, how you were involved in this fossil dig.
We found a shark tooth from a quarry up in northern Michigan, and this particular tooth was important because it was the oldest occurrence of this particular genus in all of North America, if not also the entire world. And that's important because it helps to extend the range in which we knew that this particular animal lived. It was from an ancient shark called Phoebotus, and these sharks were interesting in that they had teeth that almost look like little grappling hooks. They're very similar to the modern day furled shark, actually. So I helped Dr. Swinehart to identify the tooth. I specialize in Paleozoic shark teeth, and that's what I did my research on for my master's. So Dr. Swinehart was looking for fossils, found this tooth, and then contacted me because I know a little bit about this and asked me to help ID it. So I helped him with that and the write-up.
So what is it like to dig for fossils? What are the expectations when you begin? Do you have an idea when you start of what you might find? Is it a total sort of randomness as to what you'll find during the dig? What is that like?
It depends on where you go and what you're looking for. If I were to go fossil hunting in the area where I live, for example, I live in an area that has a bunch of native coral reefs. Mm-hmm. So there's a good chance that I'd find brachiopods or ancient squid fossils or corals or whatnot. I'm not going to expect to find a dinosaur in this area. But if we were to, say, go looking for fossils in an area where we find dinosaur bones, like in the Elk Creek Formation where I went with Dr. Swinehart, then we would expect to find dinosaur bones, crocodile bones, even fossilized plants, amber. So there's a certain amount of chance that goes into what you find, but we still can also have a general idea of what we're going to find. But then sometimes we're surprised, and that's what happened with this shark tooth, actually. This particular tooth had never been reported from that location. So when Dr. Swinehart saw a speck of blue on a rock, he picked it up, wondering if it was something, and as it turns out, it was.
Talking with Matthew Honig with us, 2017 graduate of Hillsdale College, biology major, took part in some fossil digs while here and since then as well. How would you say that Hillsdale helped prepare you for what you're doing now?
Hillsdale prepared me in many ways. The academics are very rigorous, and as such, the coursework at Hillsdale helped prepare me to succeed for my master's program. And it also helped me to succeed in the job that I just worked previously. I worked as a lab tech at a corn mill, and I'm now working at an environmental company. In both of those instances, the coursework and lab work that I had at Hillsdale proved very advantageous for what I'm doing now because they taught me many of the ideas behind science and the philosophy of data collection and whatnot. I also have a side gig as a freelance scientific writer, and Hillsdale helped me to learn a lot about writing. In many ways, help prepare me to succeed in what I'm currently pursuing.
One final question for Matthew Honig. You were a chemistry minor, a German minor. I know you were also very involved in the music program here at Hillsdale College as well. How did all of those things help to perhaps create in you a well-rounded student and a well-rounded college experience?
I believe that. And I believe Hillsdale College also would share this belief that the end goal of education is the development of the human soul. And to that end, education cannot be limited to strictly learning a bunch of facts or learning a particular set of motions or whatnot. We believe that education should go deeper than that. And to that end, during my time at Hillsdale, not only did I learn valuable technical skills from my field, but I also learned a lot about, you can use some of the choice Hillsdale buzzwords, like self-government and as many things that are core to the human experience in the West and whatnot.
Matthew Honig, 2017 graduate of Hillsdale College, biology major, chemistry and German minor, and currently working as an intern with an environmental company in Ohio, also taking part in those fossil digs in these past couple of years. Matthew, thank you so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
You're welcome. Glad to.
And that will wrap up this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to Khalil Habib from Hillsdale's Politics Department, describing to us nationalism versus cosmopolitanism. Peter Wood, author of 1620, A Critical Response to the 1619 Project. Matt Gaetano from Hillsdale's History Department told us all about Pico's oration. And Hillsdale graduate Matthew Honig on digging for fossils. Remember, you can hear new episodes every week on this station. You also can find extended versions of some of our interviews or listen anytime to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour podcast. Find it at SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, TuneIn, Stitcher, Spotify, or Amazon Podcasts. The assistant producer of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour is Nate Esbenshade. To find out more about Hillsdale College, head to hillsdale.edu. Until next week, I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
KCNR 96.5 FM, AM 1460, and online at am1460.com. Join me weekday mornings from 6 to 7 with the Sue McClain News Hour. I'll have your up-to-the-minute local news, national and international news, weather, sports, and a whole lot more. Followed by Free Fire Radio from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. From 9 to noon, be informed and laugh along with Armstrong and Getty, the conscience of the nation. From noon to 3, find your financial peace with Dave Ramsey. From 3 to 6, don't miss constitutional expert Mark Levin. Monday through Thursday night, starting at 6 p.m., we have local shows featuring everything from the paranormal to riding routes, pop culture, and unsung heroes of our area. From 7 to 9, tune into Ben Shapiro with an expanded program that brings the issues of the day to your radio. KCNR, 96.5 FM, AM 1460, and online at am1460.com.
Want to have the most unique, memorable Valentine's weekend? Shining Care presents The Shining Affair. Saturday, February 13th, 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. The best part? It's happening from the comfort and safety of your own home. It's an elegant, virtual evening of interactive entertainment, including live music from FM Flyby. Enter or watch a fun lip-sync challenge, the Best in Bling contest, and much more. You join the party with Zoom and let the fun begin. With the party in a box, you'll have all the content to create your own festive backdrop for everyone to see. Plus, mingle and see everyone's bling attire on your Zoom screen. Join CR Gibbs mixologists in making a signature cocktail. Vote on the lip sync challenge performances and best in bling outfits. Be moved by testimonials of Shining Care's mission of compassionate support, expert guidance, and assistance to at-risk elders for safety and well-being. Tickets start at just $25, available at shiningcare.org. Proceeds benefit Shining Care's programs to help at-risk elders in our community.
Hi, this is Dr. Patricia Bay, and my radio show, Therapy in a Nutshell, which airs on Saturdays at 11 a.m. on KCNR, 1460 a.m., or 96.5 FM, is a great show for you to listen to and learn how to effectively change your life. We talk about issues such as communication and trust, couples issues, and many more. Also, you can listen to the radio show on my podcast through the Anchor app, which is free and safe. Or you can tune into the iTunes or Spotify podcast and listen to it there. It's a nice show that'll help you throughout the day and throughout your life. So join me for Therapy in a Nutshell, Saturdays, 11 a.m. at KCNR Radio. This is Dr. Patricia Bay, trying to heal the world 1 hour at a time.
You get me every time. You know, it can be difficult to find a trustworthy, knowledgeable, and yet affordable auto repair shop. Advanced Automotive is a second-generation, locally owned, full-service repair shop serving our community since 1993, and one of only four AAA-approved auto repair shops in the Reading area. Advanced Automotive has a goal, and it's to keep it simple to have safe, reliable vehicles for our customers and our community. Call or come by to meet the crew who is here to serve you. 244-4423. Advanced Automotive.
Colonoscopy is the most effective method of screening for colon cancer and is the only procedure that can both detect and prevent cancer in one procedure. Take-home tests can miss up to 1 in 12 of colon cancers and most precancerous polyps. If you're 50 or older, now is the time to schedule this life-saving test. When caught early, the survival rate of colon cancer is 90%, so stop making excuses and get screened. This public service message is brought to you by Reading Endoscopy Center. Call him at 530-246-7000 or visit readingendoscopy.com.
You know, it can be difficult to find a trustworthy, knowledgeable, and yet affordable auto repair shop. Advanced Automotive is a second-generation, locally owned, full-service repair shop serving our community since 1993, and one of only four AAA-approved auto repair shops in the Reading area. Advanced Automotive has a goal, and it's to keep it simple to have safe, reliable vehicles for our customers and our community. Call or come by to meet the crew who is here to serve you. 244-4423. Advanced Automotive.
Hi, this is Brian Martin, General Manager of River Commons Senior Living. One of the most rewarding things about what I do is watching the positive transformation that often occurs when a senior moves here to our beautiful, independent retirement community. Seniors can become isolated, find it hard to eat good, healthy meals, and even just get around. I call this a failure to thrive. At River Commons, we solve those challenges. You are surrounded by friendly people with similar life experiences. Chef Shalisa and her crew provide three delicious and healthy meals daily. Activities Director Ernie always has a wide variety of things to do, from arts and crafts to outings on our 25-passenger bus. Plus, we provide utilities, cable TV, scheduled transportation, weekly housekeeping, and more. We see seniors go from survive to thrive, and that is just a wonderful thing. Call today for a tour or luncheon a tour and experience River Commons for yourself. 221-2121 or on the web river-commons.com.
Colonoscopy is the most effective method of screening for colon cancer and is the only procedure that can both detect and prevent cancer in one procedure. Take-home tests can miss up to 1 in 12 of colon cancers and most precancerous polyps. If you're 50 or older, now is the time to schedule this life-saving test. When caught early, the survival rate of colon cancer is 90%, so stop making excuses and get screened. This public service message is brought to you by Reading Endoscopy Center. Call him at 530-246-7000 or visit readingendoscopy.com.
Some things in life you can just rely on, like the comfy fit of a favorite pair of jeans and the tried and true performance of a new home comfort system from Rood. So here's to reliability built into everything we do. Rely on Rood.
Get reliable comfort when the weather turns cold with a new heating system installed by the local pros at Alliance Heating and Air. Call Alliance Heating and Air today at 530-221-2642.
Tune in to North State Now Thursday nights at 6 p.m. on KCNR 96.5 FM and 1460 AM. Our show features yours truly, Linda Bott, with Michelle Slade, Enjoy the Magazine, and Dr. Orna Gill, featuring music, art, health, wellness, shopping, and more.
When you're looking to add a pet to your family, Haven Humane Society is a place to start. Hi, this is Mark from Haven to tell you that shelter pets make the best pets. With kittens, puppies, dogs, cats, bunnies, guinea pigs, hamsters, snakes, birds, and more, Haven has a pet that is the right fit for your family. We also provide education, training, spaying and neutering, dog licensing, and so much more. If you're looking for a way to help, our amazing volunteers have fun with the animals while helping us to save lives. For more information, call 241-1653 or visit havenhumane.org. Like us on Facebook and follow our progress as we work towards a day with no more homeless pets in the North.
What is happening in the state of Jefferson? To find out, listen to the Jefferson State of Mind program Sunday mornings at 9 a.m. on KCNR with your hosts Wing Carpenter and Terry Raposa. To catch up on past broadcasts or to listen anytime, go to KCNR1460.com and click on the archives link.
ACA, come out and play. Have you seen the bill? We all have to pay. The time has come for 51 in a Jefferson State of Mind.
Where do you go in Shasta County to get advice on the best type of firearm to meet your needs and how to safely carry and use it? The answer is to join the revolution at locally owned Bastiani Arms. Bastiani Arms believes in a better way to serve their customers and providing them with all the information needed to make the right decisions before and after the sale. They have a large selection of guns and ammunition and always special discounts for veterans. Self-protection is your right. Join the revolution at Bastiani Arms, 2539 Larkin.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.